Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the Fine Watchers podcast. I'm Ben, your host. Joining me this time is Fred Mandelbaum, an incredibly knowledgeable collector and world-renowned expert on Breitling. This is a very, very comprehensive discussion about 20th century watchmaking, and whether you're a beginner or a seasoned watch lover, I recommend grabbing a pen and paper because Fred's watch knowledge is absolutely astounding. I hope you enjoy the episode as much as I enjoyed having the discussion with Fred. Episode 6 of the Fine Watchers podcast. Here we go. Can we start, Fred, with a wrist check? What have you got on today?
I happen to wear the Navitimer re-edition.
Beautiful.
Which is a watch I'm deeply attached to, both the original and the re-edition, and it's the first re-edition I was responsible for, and I happily wear it. It's a lovely watch.
Fabulous. I have a Citizen Bullhead. Bullhead Chrono, which was the first sort of serious watch in my collection. So, first of all, Fred Mandelbaum, internationally recognized Breitling expert and collector of watches, thank you so much for joining me for this episode of the Fine Watchers podcast. I very much appreciate your time. Let's get started. You've said in other interviews and around that you didn't start out to become a Breitling expert or to indeed collect Breitling, but you were a lover of chronographs. Can you tell us about how your collecting got started in the very early stages and some of the pieces that fostered this love of chronos?
Yeah, I can. How did it start? I've never decided to collect watches. It isn't something that, wake up in the morning, say, what am I going to do today? And then go and start collecting watches, at least not the way that I think watch collecting should be. Mechanical watches have been a part of my life forever. And somehow they were tools, like watches are tools per definition. And when I was just starting out in business, and I'm old enough to admit how old I am. That was the late 1970s and very early 1980s, and everybody was wearing quartz watches. And as I was one of the quote unquote early adopters of personal computing and software development for personal computers, well before the IBM PC was launched, well before MS-DOS was launched, electronics were an everyday part of my life. So there was no specific interest to have another piece of electronics on my wrist. So I've stayed with mechanical watches forever, actually. Now, when was it more than just the thing you strapped? When did it start to be more than the thing you strapped on your wrist? There's no specific time, but if we're looking at the period of crisis for the Swiss watch industry, the 1970s, and then in the early to mid 1980s, a slow revival of mechanical watches. And I was there to witness it. The revival actually very much started in a country that may be surprising to some. It started in Italy, where all those unbelievably elegant Italian men started to wear mechanical watches again. That's the time, and actually it wasn't the first watch I've noticed, but that was the time when also Breitling and Ernest Schneider revived the chronomat in an environment where still generally nobody really believed in the future of mechanical chronographs. And it wasn't only that. It was a guy called Patrizi who was not actually selling pocket watches, because this is what people collected then, started to do auctions for wristwatches. And I was noticing, and then probably the first time I've looked into, quote unquote, the idea of collecting was an absurd moment. I was doing reasonably well, really, and I'd just bought a very, very nice car. And then I saw an announcement for an Ulysse Nordin. I don't know if you've ever seen that was the Astrolabium. And I was blown away. I was blown away by its beauty. It was designed by one of the genius watchmakers, Oechslin. And I was blown away by it, blown away by its beauty, by its mechanical wonders, and also by the fact that it was absurdly unaffordable. It was, I don't remember how much it was, but I just bought a very, very nice dream car then, for me, a BMW 735i with all the trimmings and everything. And then I looked at the price tag of that watch, and it was like four of these BMWs or something like that. Absurdly expensive, really. Yes. This actually was one of the triggers of the interest. And it was a time where business was good, surprisingly good. So my first good watch, and probably triggered by the Astrolabium, was a Jaeger LeCoultre Memovox. Brand new, nice, very mechanical, and a tool again, because I just thought having an alarm watch would be nice. So that's how mechanical watches, or quote unquote collectible watches, expensive watches, etc., started to appear in my life. And then, being an inquisitive person in general, the next quote unquote good watch was certainly cheap. Again, don't remember how much it was. It was a vintage Memovox. And I actually saw that it was a tenth of the price or something like that, absurdly cheap in comparison to the new one.
For interrupting you. The original 50s, 60s Memovoxes are unbelievably cheap for what they are still.
Oh, absolutely. But they were as cheap. Again, I don't know. It was something like 10% of the new one. You know, went to buy that new Memovox at a jeweler on the Kärntnerstrasse in Vienna, and the price tag did hurt. And then I saw a vintage piece, as beautiful as the new one, for me, even maybe a bit more beautiful, and it was a tenth of the price. So, I bought another Memovox, and then the next mechanical watch was, again, being me, started looking into what other nice alarm watches were out there, and the next one was a Vulcan Cricket, of course.
Eric Wind is a huge fan of the crickets, he tells me.
Yeah, they're lovely. I mean, that's actually one of the last watches that I've bought was a cricket nautical, a super compressor, and one of the truly impressive watches. It for years was the watch with the highest quote unquote verified water resistance, as a Swiss diver had taken it down in lakes in Switzerland, and the alarm worked perfectly well at depth of 200 meters. Not that I'd ever been in a situation to meet that, but an impressive piece. But we're jumping ahead. Let's go back, then the next tool function of a wristwatch that looked interesting for me was a chronograph, because watch this out. People in the times before people had like mobile phones and used them for that, the watch was something that you used all the time. So we're going through production steps in an assembly line, actually, an early assembly line, later 80s. It must have been. Don't really remember the day, precise year. And I said, a chronograph would be nice. It would be good to time those production steps. Let's start looking into that. And I bought my first chronograph that I actually still have. And it happened to be a smart buy, but it took me years to understand what it was. It was a Girard Perregaux. But it was one of the early Girard Perregaux that were actually manufactured by Excelsior Park or Jean-Ray Brame, something that I still consider the caliber 04 and 42. I still consider them one of the most wonderful chronograph calibers ever built. So this happened to be my first chronograph. And then... Again, no precise date to set. I started to read about chronographs that must have been around the times Benno Richter published his first Breitling book. So this was one of the early books. And that book had a breathtakingly beautiful piece on the cover. It was a Breitling duograph. Funnily enough, we just found out that I know the guy who owned the watch, who sold the watch in the end, and that watch was stolen. That's the only thing that we have about that watch is that picture, really, that appeared on the Benno book. Yeah. So again, you start to read, you start to understand, you start to question the general perception of people who don't know about the true history, who look at price tags or whatever to say what's a desirable watch and what isn't. And when you start looking into subject, you just learn. So I started to learn that Breitling actually in all the relevant steps of that particular field, like in alarm watches, we know that Vulcain preceded Memovox and actually is, with all due respect to that wonderful Memovox, technically incomparably more intricate and quote unquote advanced than the Memovox is. The Memovox is crude in comparison to what the cricket is. It was similar with chronographs, actually. So a basic interest started looking into Breitling, and as sad as it is, learning that Breitling were back to the 1940s, actually, one of the most widely faked brands. I don't know why that happens, but the first three Breitlings that I've bought, I still own them. I don't show them to anyone because I'm ashamed to admit that they're all fakes. Some nice, some actually close to the real thing. Two of them blatant, laughable, crude fakes, but I just didn't know. It took me years to learn what makes a Breitling authentic and what shows that it isn't, what makes it a Franken watch, what makes it pure fantasy, etc. So I've paid the price for my knowledge over the years.
Can I ask a quick question? The obvious reason that people fake watches is that people can't afford a prestige watch, and so they want to buy a fake Rolex or a fake Vacheron or a fake whatever. Was that the reason for the production of the imitation Breitlings? Or
No, I don't think that was the reason. The reason was that The watches carried a premium over other brands. I spoke about that with a very interesting person. The guy who quote unquote made Breitling, the two actually, or three. That's Willy Breitling, of course, the innovator and the guy that led Breitling for 40 years. And then there was his American distributor, a guy called Ico Wachmann, and his sales manager, then the guy who took over Wachmann US, a guy called Jack Karasek. I spoke to Jack Karasek. He passed away some month ago. He was 99 years old. It took me 30 years to find him, and I did. Really happy that I had the chance to meet him and talk to him for hours and record him for hours. We'll publish that, of course, what we've learned there. But just a tidbit of a conversation. He told me, "Look, we couldn't do Breitling only. We had to have our own brands." That's also one of the discussions that typically pop up. What's a Wachmann? And where's the connection to Breitling, etc.? And he said, no, we just had to do our own quote-unquote mid-range or entry-level brand because Breitling was double to triple the price of watches that would be functionally similar. So yes. We did our own brand. So a similar reason, Breitling was expensive with very, very high production quality. You could take a standard quality watch, slap a Breitling logo on it and try to sell it for double the price. And this is how we start seeing faked Breitlings that have been in families since the 1940s. And I see no reason to not believe someone when he brings me a watch he had inherited from his grandfather, tells, and it's not only one, there've been many over the years. And we find out that the watch that had been in the family for 50, 60 years or so was sadly fake. So there was a market for fake Breitlings since the 1940s, apparently, in the same way that there was a market for fake Rolex, etc. I mean, it was in the 1950s, there was a huge cottage industry in Hong Kong already manufacturing fake Rolexes.
Just to touch on Wachmann, their triple date chronograph, that black with the dials, is an absolutely beautiful, iconic chronograph, in my opinion.
Well, it is. And they did several, we're really jumping now, but they actually had two lines themselves. So they had Breitling, then they had mid-range watches manufactured by Gigondé in Switzerland, which were actually very, very decent quality watches, most of them with Valjoux movements. That triple date chronograph is an example. They called it the President and the Emperor, by the way. And then they had what I consider entry level watches manufactured by Yema in France. So some of the Wachmanns were made in France, also stamped made in France on the movements. And then you've got the quote-unquote better quality pieces done in Switzerland by Gigondé. And then way above that, you had the Breitlings. And the only thing that connected these watches was the fact that they shared the same distributor for the United States.
Right. So we've sort of touched a little bit on what was to be my next question about your love of chronos, that obviously Breitling have done some pretty amazing things some pretty iconic models, the Navitimer and so on over time. What are some of the, I'm assuming in the early days of your collecting before you started focusing on Breitling, you must have bought some other chronos. What are some other chronos that you...
Still do. I'm far from being a Breitling only guy. Now the thing is, and that may be again something we will talk about is what kind of collector are you? Are you the show-off collector? Are you the investment collector? Are you the knowledge enhancing collector? I think these are very, very different people we're talking about. They may all buy watches, but due to very different reasons, and they may all show watches also due to very different reasons. So you see me posting a lot about Breitling, or you did see me even in the days where I had no quote unquote official connection to Breitling, but was widely ignored by the original owners, the Schneiders, is that I had built relevant knowledge about them that I wanted to share.
Sure.
Now, in comparison to that, my knowledge about Omega Speedmasters pales in comparison to other people.
Sure.
So I have little to say about them or add about them, beside the fact that I love them, own them, collect them. You may, I don't know, maybe each 20th of my posts on Instagram will be another brand. So no, it's absurd. I'm a pack rat. No, actually, I'm not a pack rat. I'm a completist in a way. I try to be as complete in any segment where I collect as I can realistically be. As I'm interested in many subjects, I collect many, many watches. I just don't show them as much as I do my Breitling. So I, again, triggered by that first chronograph and the Jean-Roy Brehm caliber of 04. I, of course, collect Excelsior Park as many as I can. When you collect Excelsior Park, you, of course, also collect Galets.
Yes.
And then you start being interested in early waterproof chronographs, and then you collect more Galets, clamshells, and Schmitz Freer based cases, and collect those with different brands. And then you continue to Mido, the multi center, which again was a very early waterproof chronograph. So the list goes on. And then I'm, of course, very interested in aviator chronographs, being a Breitling collector, but you can't do Breitling only. So you look at Jadur, for example, that were trendsetters, important innovators in that segment, and have some beautiful watches. And then you look into military aviation, and then you, of course, need a Breguet. And when you have a Breguet, you need a Vixer. And when you have a Vixer, you need an Oricost. And when you have an Oricost, you need a Dodan. And when you have a Dodan, you need an Aerofix, and whatnot. Again, the moment Crazy Fred is starting to look into aviator chronographs, he'll collect them all, or try to collect them all, and have all the executions that Dodan ever did for the French army. And then you land in Italy, and you have a Zenith Carelli, and then you have a Leonidas, and then you need the Breitling, of course, that was done for the army. And then when you have that Leonidas, You, of course, need the Leonidas that they did for the German Bundeswehr. The first Bund actually was a Leonidas and not a Heuer. And it goes on and on and on. So no, I cast a very, 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 very wide net in my collecting, because when you have the Zenith Karedi, you look at the Excelsior Park that used the same case in its revival. And when you have the Excelsior Park, you'll be hunting a bull of a Marine Star. So no, far, very, very, and not to forget any car, of course. And when you have, and then you need Universal Genève, and then you need Longines. So as I said, it's absurd, okay? But again, the things I talk about on Instagram and forums, etc., I'll talk about more, is where my knowledge has any relevance. And there's people I ask about any car. There's people I ask about Universal Genève. And I enjoy them a lot. But as I said, I'm not the one to ask. So showing them too much would be showing off. And that's not what I normally try to do.
You touched on something in your answer there that I wanted to talk to you about. I've seen you've mentioned in a couple of interviews and articles and so on where you mentioned a number of types of collectors earlier, but the two classifications that made the most sense to me, and the simplest classification that I've seen you make, is the two types of collectors are: one is someone who seeks to impress by the piece that they have, and the other is someone who collects because they love whatever they're collecting. And I think that can apply not only to watches, but cars, art, books, everything. I think that's a fundamental human trait. I personally feel more affinity with the second group, the people who collect and do what they do because they love it, rather than I just want to buy a X brand watch, car, whatever, because it returns some kudos to me. The question that I wanted to ask you is, as a collector and a watch expert, and as someone who seeks to enrich the watch collecting community, not only with Breitling but other brands, do you think there is a way to enlighten those in the first group, perhaps to stray from the well-known brands and models to foster a wider appreciation, or do you think that that's their personality type and they're not going to stray?
No, I tend to believe, or at least hope, that I've influenced quite a number of people over the years. People who start questioning their own approach of just, you know, buying another Rolex because two of their friends already have one, and animating them to look deeper into the subject. I'd add a third group, although group one and group two often do overlap. One is really the quote unquote envy driven collecting.
Sure.
The guy I admire has that watch, and I should have that too, because I'll feel, may all those that act like that forgive me. I'd like to impress too, and I need something to impress. Then there's a very wide group, a growing group, especially during the last years, who collect watches because they see them as an asset class. And then there's people who fall in love with watches, who start to be true collectors. And for me, any true collector actually strives to learn, strives to add to the knowledge base, tries to understand. And by understanding, gaining the means to help others. That's very much my type of collecting and my friends' type of guy. Look at a guy like Jeff Steen, for example. Who's made Hoyer a collectible in many ways, because he's built a huge knowledge base, a forum, a database, everything you need to know about Hoyer, not because he tries to impress someone, but again, Jeff's a close friend, has become a close friend over the years, but that's someone who really changed watch collecting by what he did, for example. So that's one type. And then I'm in discussions with people, and I must admit, and again, please don't misunderstand me. I pity people who talk and can talk for hours how much their Patek or whatever has risen in price. And the moment I hear that these watches are still sealed, and sealed in their safes.
Why do you have
it? They've never been worn. They've never been wound. They've never been set. These guys never saw those beautiful dials and hands sparkle in the sun. I really pity them, because this isn't what watch collecting should be about. There's one return on investment. And I've seen people who've, started collecting in the early 2000s, when people collected different things than today. Yes. And they've those watches still sealed in their safes. And instead of gaining value, they lost value. They'll never be able to sell them for the prices they bought them for. And the one guaranteed return on investment that I get from every watch I own is the smile that it puts on my face when I look at it. Okay, yes. The joy it brings me. That's the only return on investment we can be sure about, because I have no idea how the market will develop. Will people in 20 years from now collect the same watches we collect today? Is that return on investment that everybody dreams about guaranteed? Can tell you from experience with my stocks, etc. No, it isn't. Okay. So they're losing out. They're losing out for... is a good dinner an investment? Some people may see it as an investment because they took someone to dinner to impress him. But again, that's not the way that I go out and eat. I go out and eat to enjoy and have a good time with my wife, my daughter, above all my friends, and the things that I remember are, the smells of wildflowers while I was sipping a glass of red wine in San Gimignano. This is staying with you forever. Yes. The dinners in multi Michelin-starred restaurants, these are mostly forgotten for me. So again, everybody is his own person, but I can only say putting sealed watches in safes isn't the way my watch collecting is.
I think there's an important distinction that I've discussed with several of my guests before, and I think a combination of the conversation that I had with two previous guests. One was William Messina, and the other was Phil Toledano, Mr. Enthusiast. And William had a very simple definition of what a watch collector is. And a watch collector is just someone who owns some watches. And if you define it that way, it's very simple and it's very, very true. Not necessarily accurate from a dictionary point of view, but very true that you can own $200 or $300 old Seikos and you're a watch collector. You know, own a few secondhand Casios and you're a watch collector. Then if you explore the concept just that one step further, which I did with Phil, that there are several levels. So collector is the first level, which is just owning things. So as soon as you start to accumulate things and you've got the money to buy them or however you come across them, that's the first level. The second level is an enthusiast. So someone who actually gets a feeling from it and knows something about it and so on. Then you have, you know, a watch aficionado who is someone who really knows something in depth about the topic, an extraordinary amount. And then Phil added a fourth category, which was a watch zealot, which is an evangelist, which is somebody who then goes out and tells people about it and shares their enthusiasm. It's not just a private enthusiasm. I think it's interesting that I think to me, the investor class watch collector or watch owner is not necessarily, to me, falls kind of outside of the watch enthusiast community, because I mean, not necessarily the individual may be any one of those four categories, but the idea of buying an asset, whatever it is, whether it's a car, a piece of art, a share, you know, a stock or whatever, and putting it away for the idea of financial reward and capital value expansion, capital gain, is a completely different concept to what a watch enthusiast has, which is the wonder of this little machine on the wrist that has a combination of a very rational function of telling the time or measuring a period of time like a chronograph or showing the moon phase or whatever it happens to be, and combining it with this beauty of design and so on. And it's, yeah, I think they're very, very different things. And I think that there are too many people who, and they tend to fall into that first category that I spoke about before, about the people who want to impress. There are too many people who think that the watch on their wrist, and it's interesting that you mentioned Rolex, because Rolex is going through a massive boom in price and value and desire and conversation traffic and everything, as perhaps Panerai did a few years ago or whatever. But yeah, I think it's very interesting that it's important to make the distinction between someone who just owns something and is someone who's enthusiastic about it and knowledgeable about it.
Absolutely. Very different. And I mean, then there's another question. The only question I've never answered and probably never will, when somebody sits and looks at my state, that they'll be counted for the fact. People ask me, how many watches do I own?
Yes.
That's one of those standard questions I've been asked quite often. And I say that's the last thing of relevance. Truly, the last thing of relevance is how many watches you have. Because again, it's also a subject we can talk about for hours and won't, because we're already at 50 minutes. What makes a watch collectible? And what type of watches or what condition should they have? So the first thing I'm telling people is don't collect what conventional wisdom tells you, or the last Esquire article or whatever, try to see what watches really speak to you, what sure. watches truly attract you. Then, of course, next step is try to learn about them. Try to truly understand what you're talking about, what you're looking at. Then, of course, if we're looking on at building that, I think there's a difference. I'm not totally with Bill and Phil. William prefers to be called William. William and Phil here. I'd say a collector. No, you can't be a collector with three watches that you just happen to have bought over the years. You're a watch accumulator. Almost everyone is over the years. You buy watches here and there. You're sitting at an airport, walking by a swatch shop. You have another 3 hours to wait. You have nothing to do. So you buy another swatch or whatever. Malls in the whole world are still full of those watches that people accumulate. So you can own 2,000 watches and not have a watch collection. And you can own five and be a world-class collector, because a watch needs some relevance. It has ideally relevance for you in combination with relevance for the segment we're talking about. So ideally, it should have some meaning. If it's a chronograph, it should have relevance in the arena of chronographs, not be a Me Too slapped on logo, mass produced something.
Yes.
If you collect alarm watches, same thing. So it should have relevance. Next is, of course, condition, originality. And that's where you start building a relevant collection. So you can have five beautiful moon phase chronographs with all the relevant calibers ever done in that particular segment, for example, and have a collection that everybody admires and that really has pushed the envelope a little bit. You can accumulate watches as either an asset or just as more junk in a drawer, and you'll never be a watch collector. And for me, the last point is, I think the true collector, I don't know if it's a zealot, I'm unsure, those definitions are hard. For me, a collector, again, isn't someone collecting alone for himself. That reminds me a bit of those horror stories we hear of fine art that's hidden in some safe somewhere, not loved, not admired, not shared. So you can't be a collector alone. You need to be a collector in communication with others. So the friendships that develop around collecting, the partnerships in a way that collect really start around collections. That's what really makes collecting so relevant.
I agree with everything you're saying, and I think it, you know, aside from semantics around the actual words used, it sounds like really the three key themes that we've touched on with collecting. And I must say, this conversation has gone very deeply into something that I feel very passionate about. I initially thought we'd talk a bit more about Breitling, because that's how I was introduced to you and your collecting. And I'm glad that we've gone down this road. The three, I guess, motivations, really, if we talk about the collecting, one is the impressing bit. So there's still people showing what they have, but then it's about their motivation and about how other people think about them. The second is the actual love and knowledge, which is a combination of both emotional things of I love it, it makes me happy and that, but also a sort of a rational knowledge thing about that you know about a topic or a subject in depth, whether it's wine or art or watches, doesn't matter. And the third is a completely separate phenomenon, which is I bought this painting, but I put it in a safe to keep it safe and no one can see it. Yeah, I think for me, the important thing is actually know what you have and enjoy what you have. Don't buy things to impress somebody else. That's the main thing for me.
Because you've asked that in the beginning and we really went astray which is always fine and which is actually what podcasts should be, because they shouldn't be PR events in general. But let me try and sum up as quickly as I can why Breitling is the ideal target of a collector. So we've got a company who's been the consistent leading innovator, one of the leading innovators of any relevant change in a specific market. And as absurd as it is, I always bring that example of, in 100 years from now, there probably will be people collecting early smartphones. And there will be Samsungs, and there may be Alcatels, and there'll be all types of smartphones that surround us today. But the core of the collection, or relevant part of the collection, will probably always be the iPhone, because it was the first and defining mover in any relevant direction we've seen in that particular market. And Breitling is actually very similar. If you have an open mind, if you look at the first time a chronograph appeared on a man's wrist, there's still discussions about that. But Breitling was one of the first to do that in 1912, 1913. Then we have the first separate push piece, because early chronographs actually were based on wristlets, okay, not developed for the wrist. So they had the pushers in the crown, like our pocket watches had. And the first one was said, that doesn't make sense. We need a separate pusher to start and stop and reset the chronograph. Was again a Breitling, the first who said, okay, maybe we need another button, a separate button to pause and restart. Was again a Breitling, and the first to put a slide rule on a chronograph and say, look, watches isn't enough. Let's do something smart with a watch, and let's put a tool that every businessman and mathematician and engineer uses every day. Let's give it to him on the wrist, and let's combine the computer, that's what they were called, and the watch. Was again a Breitling, and we may for hours discuss who the first automatic chronograph was, because another kind, and again, I admire Zenith, I collect El Primeros, etc.
I think Seiko had a flash in that argument
and,
as well.
And Seiko, etc. But it's actually irrelevant. Actually, all points, and we'll do a separate podcast about that.
I'd love
because
to.
We discover more and more, of course, the deeper I go into the records of Breitling, the more I... Again, lucky break to have found Jack Horacek, who was with the company from 1947 onwards. Unbelievable, actually, to have the ability to talk to him. So we know how they started to work with TWA, came to equip the first Boeing 707s, all that really from the guy who did it. But again, so all indications are that Breitling was actually, together with Heuer, far ahead when mass production, when all the others weren't. The first patent was filed in September 1967, years ahead. But again, we are forgetting, for example, that actually part of that Breitling and Heuer concept lives on in hundreds of high-end watches until today. It lives on in Richard Mille's, because what they did is they did the first chronograph module. They did the first modular chronograph movement, and you look into almost any brand, be it Audemars Piguet, be it Richard Mille, be it Breitling, be it Omega, etc. Those modules co-designed by Breitling, Heuer, and Dubois de Prat in 1967 live on until today, and they're the best kept secret of the watch industry, because everyone is using those Dubois de Prat modules in different complications that are added to movements until that very day. So again, something widely used, widely accepted as quote unquote industry standard, again, is actually born from that particular corporation, very much influenced by Breitling. So they've been the first chronograph with contrasting white subdials, for example, was actually introduced by Breitling for their crazy dive chronograph, because they saw that you needed that contrasting white background to be able to read it underwater, etc. So there's actually endless. Wherever you look, you spoke about Panerai and the big watch. Breitling was crazy enough to do a 49-millimeter watch design in 1967. So it took Sly Stallone and another 30 years and Schwarzenegger to make that type of watch a hit. But Willy Breitling was crazy enough to say, okay, let's give that a try in 1967. So that's what makes Breitling, for me, so extraordinary, as long as we're not looking at watchmaking as an art. That's also something to think about. I'm really interested in the watch as a tool, so as a mass-produced tool for everyone. I admired Audemars Piguet, I admire Patek Philippe, but these were, you know, horological art in a way, never really meant to be tools, but really a piece of art on your wrist. Breitling produced tools, mass-produced tools.
I'm aware that I've taken up the time that you so generously gave me. There were so many things that I wanted to talk to you about, and I would love to talk to you again. A few of the things that, if I can be presumptuous about a part two, I really want to get your story about the Breitling emergency. It's a very storied watch with rumors about the cost of using it if you're not actually, and does it come with a free rescue and all that. But perhaps we can talk about that next time. You supplied a beautiful watch to Benedict Cumberbatch for a film, which again, I'd like to fit into perhaps another hour together. But where I like to finish all of the Fine Watches podcast is to ask my guests about your grail pieces, and specifically not just the unattainable thing that you know, money is no object, but both the accessible grail piece and the money's no object blue sky piece that you would like to add to your collection that you don't have already.
No, that's actually a sad thing I'm going to say. I'm done. I'm not hunting. There's one last Breitling that we've never seen in reality, that we just see in a 1946 catalog. One of the grails of my collect grails. Watches that I really like a lot in my collection are the Breitling Rattrapant, the duograph. Breitling, again, was development partner of Venus for their line of Rattrapant movements. Breitling actually owned the patents for the crowns and mechanisms to operate those. And I'm lucky enough to own several of them, although they were produced. These were crazily expensive watches then, so they were really manufactured in very, very small quantities. But there's one watch that appears in the 1946 catalog, and we're unsure whether Breitling ever really manufactured them. That's a Rattrapante. It's a reference 800, a Rattrapante caliber that combines Rattrapante full date and moon phase in a beautiful 38 millimeter wristwatch. So this duograph is the grail I'm hunting, but in that particular case, I'm really unsure whether that grail is a unicorn that never really existed, or whether there's a piece or two or maybe three that are still somewhere in a drawer that will be found. So that's the grail I'm hunting. And in addition to that, no, there's no grail of monetary. There's many watches, mainly from independence. You spoke about Büsser, etc. There's many watches I'd love to own that I admire, but that are not truly grails that I, you know, hunt and need to have. For me, it's enough to look at what Büsser is doing and enjoy what he does. And without really owning it, he adds to the quality of my life with his work.
Fabulous. Well, Fred, thank you so much for joining me for this. It's been a fascinating conversation. It was a very different conversation than I perhaps had thought we were going to have, but I'm very glad that it went in the direction that we did. So again, thank you for your time, and yeah, hopefully we can speak again.
It was a pleasure, Ben. Speak to you again.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Fred. He was a very knowledgeable and generous man with that knowledge. I certainly learned a lot, and I hope you did too. As always, if you like what you hear in the Fine Watches podcast, please, please rate and review. It helps us to reach more people, and it's very much appreciated. I hope you're enjoying the podcast. Please do let us know what you think. And until next time, enjoy.